Robin Hood is what happens when you cross the US share market with Candy Crush. It's an investing app for smartphones, and the median age of its 13 million users is 31 years old. The commission-free, easy-to-use interface is attracting a merry band of first-time investors who are shaking up Wall Street. And there are some similarities with New Zealand apps like Sharesies and Hatch, although there are significant differences in the way they operate. Many of the complaints my guest has about Robinhood, that it's free, that it incentivises trading, don't apply to the local apps. Well, Tara Falcone is a certified financial advisor who says the Robinhood app is like giving the keys of a sports car to a 12-year-old. Her organisation Rise Up educates millennials about financial literacy, and Tara Falcone joins me now. Hello.
Hello, it's so great to be here.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. And before we discuss Robinhood, I'd love to talk about your story, because you didn't grow up with money, did you?
No, I did not, actually. I grew up in a very blue-collar family, low-income family in rural Michigan in the States, and became financially independent at 14 after my dad passed away. And so I've had a bit of a rocky road financially before I became a financial expert myself.
And would you say you had found yourself having to deal with the dire financial situation of the adults in your life? I mean, what would you do when the creditors would call?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, my dad was the breadwinner in our family. And when he got very sick, I was just 13 years old. He was only 36. And, you know, he couldn't work anymore. And there was a lot of debt that was racked up, in my family just to kind of keep the lights on. And after he passed away, all of the creditors started calling, especially during dinner time, because back then that's when they knew you would be home. Mm. And I started, just sort of making up stories and kind of funny accents and things like that, just to try to get them off the scent a little bit. But I don't think that's a normal phone call for most 13-year-olds to have to handle. And it made me hyper aware of the dire situation that my stepmom and I were in. And it made me have to grow up much faster, I think, than I would have liked to, definitely, and much faster than I would hope any other children have to either.
Yeah, and I'm sorry you went through that. Somehow, though, you managed to stay on track. In fact, you became ducks of your school. How did you do that with all the chaos at home?
Yeah, so I really channeled all of that negative energy into my schoolwork. I was someone who really enjoyed school. I excelled there. And that was the place that I felt I had the most control when, the rest of my life was kind of a swirling tornado of, doom and sadness and grief around me. And so I just really channeled all of that negative energy into my schoolwork. I, found some teachers who became great mentors of mine that were all, rooting for me, believing in me. And between, going to class and then working 20 hours a week to help support myself and managing to play some sports here and there and do volunteer service, I made it work. But it was definitely not for, all of my own effort. There was a village of people that were there supporting me along the way.
And you got into Yale University, an Ivy League school. Was it hard for you to fit in, Tara, when you're surrounded by other students from families with money?
Absolutely. I don't think I really knew what I was getting myself into back then. And I graduated in 2011. So this was a little over 10 years ago when I first set foot on campus. But back then, they really didn't have programs available, or there wasn't much of a commitment to bringing lower income and first generation students onto campus. They had incredible need-based financial aid. So, essentially my stepmom and I's income was so low that they sort of offered me a full financial need-based scholarship. But my financial situation was something that I felt I had to sort of hide from my classmates. They were planning these, amazing trips over holiday break or spring break and, wearing certain things or carrying certain bags. And back then those were all status symbols. And, I was just sort of doing the best that I could, buying things secondhand from thrift stores and, working until midnight on a Saturday at the medical school so that I could afford to fly home for Thanksgiving and just doing the best that I could. I was definitely in the minority financially back then. I'm proud to say that that has changed. Many of the Ivy League schools have actually made an incredible commitment to bringing first generation and low income students onto campus because they recognize that, there is value in the students that maybe come from wealthier families learning things, from people like me and the backgrounds that we have too.
There was one other student who came from a low-income family who you ran into, in fact, fell in love with.
Yeah, it's sort of funny. My my husband John is also from, you know, kind of a blue collar family, and it's interesting because when I first got into Yale, granted we had these kind of preconceived notions, my family and I, of what, you know, a Yale student looks like, or you know, the kind of family that they're from, and so they sort of told me, oh, go find, you know, some, you know, some cute boy from a rich family, marry well, you know, you'll be good to go. And so my husband and I actually met at a party, and we had been kind of hanging out for a couple of months. And over lunch one day, I sort of revealed to him that I was on a full scholarship, and he was like, oh, wow, me too. And we sort of joked that at the time, the two quote unquote poor kids at Yale found each other. But it's actually been a wonderful blessing in disguise because, you know, he and I both graduated with no student loans, which most people, most young, you know, millennials and Gen Z going through college or having graduated can't say that right now. Student loans are crippling in the U.S. for young people. And so it was a wonderful blessing in disguise, actually, that we were able to graduate, and every dollar that we started making right away was our to keep. We didn't owe it to anyone.
You are, I think, eminently qualified to answer the question, how hard is it to manage basic things like saving and budgeting when no one has ever shown you how?
Not hard at all, which is the interesting part. People think that it's rocket science. People think that it's a foreign language. And I don't blame them, because if you've never been exposed to that information, or if money is something that was so taboo to talk about in your family that it was simply never talked about, then it can seem like something that's incredibly intimidating. However, doing simple things like managing cash flow, it's a simple math equation, right? It's money in and then money out. And ultimately, you are the one that is in control of, you know, where your money goes. And so you are the one that gets to make that decision of whether you are, you know, entering that credit card information onto that online store, or handing over that cash or that credit card or debit card, you know, in a physical store. And people have a lot more control over it than they think. And ultimately, I think it's really about the mindset shift of not looking at something like a budget as something that deprives you, but rather as a way to give yourself permission to spend on the things you want to spend on, and also prioritize longer term goals that you may have, whether it comes to saving or investing.
Why did you change direction and become a hedge fund analyst instead of a doctor, which I think was your original dream?
Yes, that's a great question. I was actually a pre-med Spanish major while I was at Yale, so I speak Spanish. For those of you that don't know what I look like, I'm a very pale blonde girl, so it's often surprising for most people to hear me speak Spanish. But I was sort of on this path to avenge my father's death, basically, after he passed away. I had felt that the cardiologists that he had didn't catch things early enough, and that was sort of why, you know, we went down the path that we did and why he ultimately passed away. And so, you know, I was really laser focused on becoming a better cardiologist than he had had. And by the end of my senior year, literally like 3 months before graduation, I sort of had a dream where my father kind of came to me and said, hey, I don't want you to live your life for me anymore. I want you to figure out what you're passionate about. I want you to use your talents, you know, for good and to serve others. And you need to figure out what that is. And I woke up that next morning being like, well, I guess I'm not going to medical school anymore, but what else am I going to do? I hadn't really given myself any freedom to explore, you know, other interests or other industries. I just knew that there were, you know, some of my friends were going into finance, and that the salaries that they were being offered were very attractive to me as a low-income person. And I ultimately was sick of being broke. I was sick of being intimidated by money. And I knew that if I was going to change the financial trajectory of my life and of my family's life, I had to do something about it. And so I applied to any finance job that would have me. And luckily, I found a small firm that was willing to give me a shot.
Wow. I'm speaking with Tara Falcone, a certified financial advisor. We're talking a bit about her life and her organization, Rise Up, which educates millennials about financial literacy, and also for her thoughts on the Robin Hood app, which is has become famous in the US. It's attracted millennials to investing, much in the same way as local apps like Sharesies and Hatch have. I won't say they're identical. There are significant differences, but it may ring a bell for people who've had a bit of a play with the share market for the first time. And by the way, as a hedge fund analyst, Tara, you have to find companies that are undervalued, that have potential. And you found that was your superpower. And that's a lot harder than it sounds, isn't it? If it was easy, everyone would be doing it.
Well, superpower is very gracious. But yes, I did become quite good at it. And I think there are, you know, just certain things about the way that I think and how I like to, you know, dig for red flags and always have this sort of, you know, air of skepticism in the back of my mind. And also, you know, I'm very good at in picking up on small things. I'm very intuitive. And I think a lot of that really did help me in the work that I was doing. But it's not easy, as you mentioned. People think that it's, you know, essentially throwing a dart at a board. It's not. It's much more scientific than that. There are lots of various factors that you have to take into consideration. You know, the bulk of which, at least in the work that I did, was financial statements oriented. So actually going through a company's financial statements and really, you know, dissecting those things, which is, you know, a skill and knowledge that the average individual doesn't usually have. And so, you know, what's going on with Robinhood and young people getting into the market right now and trading individual equities and stocks is very interesting and is much more akin to gambling than it is investing.
So 3 years before you launched RiseUp, a couple of guys from Stanford University launched Robinhood with the idea of democratizing trading in the market. Can you explain to us exactly what the app is?
Yeah, so Robinhood's general mission is to make trading equities and then derivatives of equities like options trading and things like that, make it much more accessible to the average individual. And in doing so, reduce fees tremendously. So before Robinhood, essentially to make a stocks trade, you had to pay a brokerage like Charles Schwab, let's say, a commission fee that was either a flat fee or was a certain number of cents or percent of the amount that you were actually trading. And so Robinhood has removed commissions from their equities trading and also, I believe, from their ETFs and index funds trading. And by doing that, they are marketing themselves as free, which interestingly enough, the average young user takes as risk-free, which are two entirely different things. Mm-hmm. But you can trade individual stocks, you can trade index funds and ETFs and mutual funds. You can also trade options or derivatives on those equities. And you can also trade on margin, which is where things start to get very dangerous, especially if you don't know what you're doing.
What makes the app so appealing to millennials?
It really targets all of the kind of like serotonin and dopamine receptors that we all have in our brains that things like casinos like to also target. So there, you know, when you place your first trade, confetti pops up on the screen. All of the colors on the app are incredibly bright. So there's neon pink and green, which show, you know, different up and down movements in securities prices. There are lots of other things. There are like top 100 traded stocks, for example, which I believe encourages herding behavior. So when you have somebody who's never placed a trade before, you know, create an account on this app, they don't know what to look for. So they go, oh, well, what are other people doing? Mm. They see this top 100 list and they're like, oh, well, if these are the top 100 stocks that other people are trading, they probably know more than me. I'm going to start trading those too. And, you know, so it's really things like that. There's lots of push notifications that encourage you to take action. And even though Robinhood does not make money or doesn't charge you a commission fee, they are making money on what's called order flow. So that means that they are encouraged and incentivized to get you to continue to trade and to trade often, because they can then package all of those trade orders and sell them to market makers who end up paying them a fee for those trades. So you really have to, what I encourage people to do is really understand that, you know, when something is free, or when a product is free, that means you are the product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really understand who on the other side of the table, who they are and how they are incentivized and what that ultimately means for your money.
And how big has it gotten? How much of a hit is Robinhood?
Enormous. In the United States, the last number that I saw was that this year alone, I believe they grew from 10 million users to 13 million users now, I believe it is. And half of those, so 6.5 million, are, this is their first time investing. So they're brand new to the investing game. And so that's very sizable. And I know that they're trading, you know, loads and loads of trades all the time. And what is most concerning to me is that because of this kind of herding behavior that you're seeing, there are stocks in the market that I say, you know, wise investors or more seasoned investors, I'm not going to say smarter investors because that's not necessarily true, but maybe more seasoned investors are staying away from because they understand the fundamentals. So things like Hertz stock, which was in bankruptcy or is in bankruptcy, things like those that, you know, fundamentally probably aren't going to go anywhere and may actually go to zero. You have these young, kind of less experienced traders on Robinhood buying them, bidding them up, going crazy. And ultimately, those stocks are trading at valuations that make really no fundamental sense.
Yeah.
And so that is having a real impact on, you know, valuations and stock prices, you know, and that then influences, you know, the price of indices and momentum in the market. And it's definitely an interesting year. 2020 is pulling out all the stops for everything this year.
Yeah. In defense of the app, I mean, isn't people bidding a stock up until it gets to a certain point, even if it's a kind of a fictional based valuation? Isn't that what a lot of the stock market has been based on over the last few decades?
Well, in my line of work, I would say no. So, you know, the way that we would price a stock is based on real fundamentals of the company. So, you know, where their financials are, where they have been, where we're projecting them to be, and then ultimately coming up with some type of intrinsic value based on, you know, real assets that they have on their balance sheet. And so, you know, for example, with Hertz or any sort of bankruptcy stock, when you're trying to understand what that actual residual equity value may be, you need to figure out, okay, you know, the company has this much in assets, they owe creditors this much. So what might actually be remaining after all of those people have been paid, because they are higher on the totem pole than you are when it comes to a payout. And so then dividing what's left by the number of shares outstanding, and that kind of gets you an actual residual value. And so for me, it's much more rooted in math than, you know, this crazy gambling, buying and selling things. What you're seeing more today is simple supply and demand, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily say that the people in the market are rational actors.
Yeah.
And definitely don't understand, you know, simple kind of fundamentals like intrinsic value.
A friend of mine in finance reckons kids, people in their 20s are checking this app in the same way they check TikTok. Is that a good analogy?
Yes, I think people are spending as much, if not more, time on Robinhood than they are on other social media apps like Instagram or Facebook or TikTok. And what I think that shows is just how addictive the app has been designed to be. Even I have to catch myself sometimes of how many times a day I'm looking at Instagram, for example. Mm. I have a Robinhood account, but I haven't funded it because I prefer to trade elsewhere. And I also am just I'm not that type of investor. I'm a much longer term buy and hold sort of investor. So I'm not looking at my investments every day. But yes, people are checking it all the time. And if they feel worried or they feel anxious that they've, oh my gosh, they've lost, you know, even something as small as like $10, they will freak out and make a trade and get out of a stock. Or they think that they're missing out on momentum on the way up, and so they'll buy a stock. And then that contributes to the price continuing, you know, to go higher than it you know, fundamentally should. Yes, it's a real addictive thing. And I've talked to many people who have said, I've had to delete the app, or I had to put it on a different screen on my phone because I just found myself checking it far too frequently.
Mm. So what's the worst that can happen though, right? I mean, kids are learning about markets. Maybe they'll learn the hard way. What are you mostly worried about? You've said it's like handing over the keys to a sports car to a 12-year-old. What troubles you?
Yeah, and I want to make clear, it's not the technology itself, it's not the company itself that I don't like. It's really the way that it's marketed to people as this free thing and this sort of riskless way to start learning about investing, when really the way that the app is designed is not, and it can have tremendous and severe ramifications for someone's life. There was actually a young man who this summer took his own life because he got into options trading, which is sort of a level above just trading individual stocks back and forth. And the reason that he ended up taking his own life was because of sort of a glitch in Robinhood's user interface that showed basically an options trade. The one that this young man was doing had two sides. And so it would execute or kind of be traded in two separate trades. And so he saw the first side of the trade come through, and it ended up showing on his account a negative, I think it was like $750,000 balance, somewhere around there. And before he had time, or Robinhood had time to show the second side of that trade that would cancel it out, he ended up taking his own life because he thought that he had somehow, you know, gotten himself into a position where he now owed $750,000 to Robinhood or to, you know, the brokerage app, and thought he had ruined his life. And in the suicide note, he wrote, you know, this should have canceled out, but to be honest, I didn't really know what I was doing anyway. And I think it's that level of freedom, you know, and giving somebody access to something potentially so powerful, or at least not well designed enough, or with enough education surrounding it, that is the most dangerous. You know, you're not just helping somebody start riding a bike with training wheels. You really are giving them the keys to a powerful machine that, you know, if not used appropriately, can have, you know, severe enough impact. You know, in this case, it was that man's life.
Yeah. By the way, we have a free helpline here in New Zealand for anyone listening who needs to talk to someone about serious issues like this. It's 1737. You can call and text if you want to chat to someone if you're having troubles. So I've been speaking to Tara Falcone. Her organisation is a financial wellness program for colleges and universities, corporations and individuals. It's called Rise Up, R-E-I-S. You can look it up, but I guess we'll finish, Tara, and ask you, what would you like people to consider before they start using one of these share trading apps?
Yeah, so what I would recommend is that most young people's first foray into investing should really be for retirement, for much longer term goals than, you know, trying to make a quick buck off of a stock trade. And so for, you know, at least in here in the US, you know, your first investing dollar should really go into, you know, your company's 401k plan or 403b plan, or into an individual retirement account like a traditional or a Roth IRA. And within those accounts, the types of investments that you should likely be starting with are more diversified investments like index funds and ETFs, because those are also very low cost. But they're, you know, you're buying sort of a basket of securities so that, you know, if one piece of that or one element of that basket goes down, the rest of them are sort of there to cushion that fall. So you're not putting all of your eggs into one basket. You're not taking on, you know, tremendous risk of just one company as you are when you buy an individual stock. So that's really what I recommend people start with. And then if there are additional dollars or discretionary dollars that you have that you want to try to put to work in the market, or you just want to, you know, have a small portion of your overall portfolio that you trade actively yourself because you enjoy it, you want to learn, then that's fine. But really the bulk of your assets when you're first starting out should really be in more diversified investments like ETFs and index funds.
And casual listeners to the show will be interested to know that Tara's advice in that matter almost exactly reflects the thoughts of our regular personal financial expert, Mary Holm, who's in every 2 weeks giving her thoughts on all aspects of money. And they both say the same things in a good way. So listen to them. Tara, it's been great to chat to you. We've got a link to your website on Hour One. And thanks so much for taking us inside this world today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This was fantastic.